Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
Before we start the program today, I'd like to take a moment to salute a dear departed friend. When I learned of the death of Gore Vidal, I saw myself 20 years ago pacing awkwardly outside Gore Vidal's room, waiting to meet him. Gore Vidal, the essayist, novelist, playwright, screenwriter, and talk show regular. Gore Vidal, easily the most articulate of his generation, who could make John Updike, Truman Capote, and even Susan Sontag cower. What would Gore do with this radio man? Maybe eat me for breakfast? Gore had exercised the right of the famous. He didn't know me, had never heard of Bookworm. Surely we would be willing to come to his hotel room to do the interview. Like children waiting for an appointment with the school principal, my then co-producer and engineer and I cringed until an irate Gore Vidal opened his door. We knew we were in for it, my quaking colleagues and I, but I didn't know that what we were in for was a life-altering experience. That interview can still be heard on the KCRW archive. What you can't hear is Gore's response afterwards, one of the weirdest feelings of relief I can remember. The recording done, Gore looked grave. "You have asked me," he intoned slowly, "some questions I have heard before." Painful courtesy was his gift. Was he readying for the kill? "That is inevitable. Also, many I have never heard. Those were very good." My innard started to unwind. Gore was a great teacher of the rituals orbiting the exacting and paying of respect. These rituals included earning respect. That is, having a work ethic, doing one's homework diligently and well. You do not talk to Gore Vidal without reading his books. Gore seemed to have an implicit rule. "I will not treat you as an equal unless you are my equal." He would pay respect, sometimes elaborate respect, with dinner invitations and intimate early morning phone confidences, but he administered tongue lashings with some regularity, quite harsh ones. I honestly think he couldn't help it. He was exasperated by stupidity, exasperated by America, by American stupidity, by bad thinking, bad writing, illness, mortality, sometimes life itself. And yet this man had perfected a generosity and regard that alternated, well, with his perfect knowledge of his intellect, his beauty, and his gift. I think he grew impatient with an America who didn't like judgment. For Gore, stern judgment is the necessary method by which we better ourselves. Yes, he became more demanding of others, but also more demanding of himself. These painful and difficult lessons are my life-altering lessons from the magnificent, the aloof, the ridiculously high-standard-bearing, deeply missed Gore Vidal. Why did he have to leave when we still need him? Now we're going to hear from Jess Walter, author of Beautiful Ruins, a perfect summer read on Bookworm. I'm going to ask you, if someone simply said, "Who are you, Jess? Where did you come from? Why don't I know your work? This is your sixth novel. You haven't been seen above ground very much." What do you say?
I don't know. I mean, I think the novelist's job is to be below ground, maybe. I've probably been writing those last few years. That's my sixth novel. I was a National Book Award finalist and won an Edgar Allan Poe Award, so I haven't exactly been hiding. But I think this novel is probably reaching a much wider audience than I've reached before.
It's a lovely book. It has a kind of satellite narration, sort of like Let the Great World Spin.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a bit in its cosmopolitan aspects of a book that I loved some years ago called Corelli's Mandolin.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It was very enjoyable. And this has the virtue as well of being a Hollywood novel as well, and an Italian novel, and a Northwestern novel. It's full of...
You forgot the Donner Party.
Oh, well,
the,
you know... The
and cannibalism, right.
The Southwestern, yes, right. As well as a great portrayal of amateur theater in Idaho.
Right.
It's a full-service novel.
Thanks, yeah. You know, I began it 15 years ago, the first time I went to Italy, and I kept putting it down to write other books, and I would pick it back up, and it sort of went along with me all these places that I traveled. And so when I went to Edinburgh for the Fringe Festival, the novel seemed to track there with me. And when I came down to Hollywood and worked on a few things, then, you know, my characters seemed to sort of go with me. And so it's, you know, something that I found myself drawn back to over the last 15 years. And I think the range of the book shows, you know, that range of time that it took to work on it.
There's a dear man who is the proprietor of a tiny hotel in Italy, well, on the coast of Italy.
Pasquale Tursi. Right.
Yes. It's 1962. And Cleopatra, the notorious American flop, is being shot in Rome and around Italy. Extras all over the place, starlets, a lot of controversy. It was probably the most talked about epic film ever. And eventually, all that got talked about were the scandals that surrounded it. And that was a discovery of the publicity business, that scandal could replace interest in the actual film. So this is a very contemporary subject.
It is. I think novelists often find themselves in some place completely by accident. And I was on the coast of Italy in the Cinque Terre, the five villages etched into the cliff sides on the Ligurian Sea, south of Genoa, and wanted to write about it at a time in which the place wasn't overrun with tourists. And I chose 1962 almost randomly. I was looking for that Fellini-esque period, you know, that I could write about Italy. And I put a woman there who was about my mother's age. My mother was dying of cancer as I started writing this. And so I was caught up in the ideas of mortality and this beautiful place. And then I had to ask myself, so what's happening in Italy in 1962? And I stumbled across Cleopatra being filmed. And this did seem as if it seemed a kind of... a moment in which celebrity became something that it wasn't before that, when scandal could sell a movie as well or maybe better than to have movie stars in the old fashion. And so the novel sort of became about that almost because of the year that I'd chosen.
Our little hotel proprietor is shocked to see, being borne by motorboat, a starlet coming to his island. It is not Elizabeth Taylor. She is off on her own, having her own tantrums. This is another starlet, impregnated during a stormy spell by Richard Burton. She is invented. What's her name?
Her name's Dee Murray. And for the longest time, when 1997, I just had a woman arriving and this man, Pasquale Tursi, standing up to his chest in the water, throwing rocks, trying to create a breakwater so he could build a beach. And like a lot of novelists who sort of write organically, I thought, who are these people? And once I realized that Dee Murray was this actress, that she'd been exiled from the set of Cleopatra, the novel really started to unfold from there. The questions that you ask yourself, why is she there? And then that leads to the next question of what happens next.
And this book is full of a writer trying to surprise the audience with new pleasures at every turn.
Thanks.
For instance, my favorite, a treatment for a screenplay by a young writer, I believe his name is Shane, Shane Wheeler.
Right.
And he has decided that he can really sell the daylights out of his script about the Donner Party, which he has yet to write.
Right. Yeah.
And the treatment appears, but he's learned some version of Hollywood metaphysics. So instead of being a treatment about deprivation leading to cannibalism, he's writing positive.
Right.
All of the language is putting a positive spin on the most desperate circumstances. And so his treatment sounds like a pitch meeting.
Yeah, it's funny because I had been in a few pitch meetings by this time, and it was such a strange form, and everyone knew the rules and the laws and the physics, that it had to be in present tense, that there would have to be some rising action, and that the character would have to be defined by this. And I had this idea that, you know, within the novel, you could write a pitch that would be a different literary form that I'd ever seen. A literary journal took that excerpt of the novel and ran it just as a movie pitch, which I'm strangely proud of, because it did. It felt to me as if the thing I set out to do was sort of accomplished.
Well, what I loved about Beautiful Ruins by my guest Jess Walter is that we get to see the difference between what a producer is looking for and what a writer gives. This book is a book by a writer who's giving the producer everything he wants, but also defiantly creating a very enjoyable and readable novel. And so what I thought would be amusing is to let you hear the producer's version of what he thinks this novel is. This is a love story, says the producer. Well, take it away.
Yeah, this is a love story, Michael Dean says. But really, what isn't? Doesn't the detective love the mystery or the chase or the nosy female reporter who is even now being held against her wishes in an empty warehouse on the waterfront? Surely the serial murderer loves his victims, and the spy loves his gadgets or his country or the exotic counter-spy. The ice trucker is torn between his love for ice and truck, and the competing chefs go crazy for scallops, and the pawn shop guys adore their junk just as the housewives live for catching glimpses of their own Botoxed brows in gilded hall mirrors, and the rocked-out dude on roids totally wants to shred the ass of the tramp-tatted girl on hookbook. And because this is reality, they are all in love, madly, truly, with the body mic clipped to their back belt buckle, and the producer casually suggesting just one more angle, one more jello shot. And the robot loves his master, Alien loves his saucer, Superman loves Lois, Lex, and Lana, Luke loves Leia till he finds out she's his sister, and the exorcist loves the demon even as he leaps out the window with it in full soulful embrace, as Leo loves Kate, and they both love the sinking ship, and the shark, God, the shark loves to eat, which is what the mafioso loves too, eating and money and Polly and Omerta, the way the cowboy loves his horse, loves the corseted girl behind the piano bar, and sometimes loves the other cowboy. As the vampire loves night and neck, and the zombie, don't even start with the zombie, sentimental fool. Has anyone been more lovesick than a zombie? That pale, dull metaphor for love, all animal craving and lurching, outstretched arms, his very existence a sonnet about how much he wants those brains. This, too, is a love story.
Jess Walter reading a section from Beautiful Ruins, his novel, that plays at being a love story. But let's get to the love. It's 50 years later, and the by now older
Pasquale. Mm-hmm.
Pasquale, the proprietor of a tiny hotel, Hotel Adequate View.
Right, yeah, yeah.
He's had his wife, three children, and he's going back to find that starlet,
right,
who once irradiated his life with the promise of mystery and joy.
Yeah.
The book is about, in its way, people getting what they wanted after they know what it's really worth wanting. You know, it's
yeah,
like a book full of the prize and the booby prize.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all have an image of what our life is and what we think it is. And when Pasquale first sees Dee, he falls in love. And clearly in the book, he falls in love not with her because he doesn't even know her, but with the moment. That moment is so important to him. He's a young man who has just designed this dream of what his life might be. And when this woman arrives, she becomes representative of that dream. And so I did. I picked the book up almost 50 years later in Hollywood, and he's come and is mistaken by a producer's assistant as someone pitching a film, when in fact he's come to find out what happened to this actress he hasn't seen in almost 50 years. And again, the novel was about sort of untangling what it is, what could be so powerful in the moment that these two met that they could go almost 50 years without seeing each other, and it would still be such a powerful moment that they'd be drawn back together.
Yes, although each of them has had lives and life after life subsequent to their meeting, they still can regard each other in that frame of idealistic, nostalgic memory as having been the image of true love for one another.
Yeah, the book for me was very much about that idea of the moment, that sort of existential idea. And so many of the characters in the present day are defining themselves as if they're in a movie, you know, or if they're in a television show. And their memories are formed almost more by the television shows and films they've seen. Whereas Pasquale and Dee had a moment to me of a kind of purity that they go back to try to create. And I think memory does that. Memory, those sorts of feelings to me are a kind of time travel. When we see someone we loved, we don't have a memory of loving them. We feel the thing over again.
Now, this is one of those books that's striving to get to the present.
Right.
What has brought everyone to this crossing of destiny?
Right. Yeah.
And what's thrilling is that not only is this a book where the idealisms that make for movies are at play, but also the truths that make for satisfactory living,
right,
that living in the moment that we all hope for.
Yeah, and I think the characters' lives were are difficult there. You know, I can't think of a character that whose actual life fulfills the daydream of the life they had, except perhaps the producer Michael Dean. The rest of the characters are stuck with some other version of their lives, and yet, that the collection of moments that make up their lives, and in the end, there are all these presents that come together, but they're not the same present. They're presents at all different moments across the spectrum of the novel, from essentially, you know, if you go far enough back from the 1840s all the way to the present day. And each of those moments, I think there is a sort of reckoning and a kind of truth in which the lives they've lived, true to the title, have been these lovely disasters, you know, these ruined lives, but with their own kind of earned beauty, I hope.
Yeah, they each have a kind of pretty picture.
Yeah.
The Donner Party. Well, wouldn't it be nice to get out to the West Coast?
Right, yeah.
But
there's
the
most extreme
snow
example.
And ice and hunger on the way. The book seems designed to show that for every lovely projection, the woman is virtually the starlet, like the figurehead on a ship, like Helen. And she has a chapter called Dee of Troy. And but that for all of our idealisms, there is a truth, whether that's cancer lurking beneath the beautiful skin or death. Are these things really what we know as destiny?
Yeah, I think so. I think life is about loss, and we meet Pasquale and Dee at the sort of the peak of their youth, the peak of that moment when we don't realize that so much of life is about loss and is about you know, dreams that, that maybe don't become what they are. And the question then becomes what you do with your life, you know? And I think the book manages to be romantic and to be realistic about the challenges people face. And that was always the challenge for me, was, is that duality possible? And I think it's, I think the lives that, when we look around at the people whose lives we admire, they're not the people who've had the greatest run of success. They're the people who've managed to live a life despite the trials, despite the disappointments, in a way that we admire.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jess Walter about his novel, Beautiful Ruins. We'll continue after this short break.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jess Walter about his new book, Beautiful Ruins, which might be said to take place between the ecstasy of a successful pitch meeting and the nightmare of an actual movie set, that somehow the reality doesn't live up to expectation, and yet expectation lives on. Yeah. It seems to me that this is a book explicitly written to be an answer to the movies, to give us everything we at one time wanted from the movies, and to take us beyond that to a not realer sense of life. Well,
yeah, I think there's a riff that one of the characters, Claire Silver, has in the book, sort of an internal riff about the place of movies in our culture. And again, I think because I started writing this as I was losing my mother, and I was thinking at one point, as memories of people fade, I have trouble sometimes conjuring her voice. But why is it I can close my eyes and capture almost any scene from The Godfather or The Godfather Part Two, and I can see them so vividly, and I can hear the voices? And it struck me that film has found its way into our DNA in a way, television and movies, and they're such a part of our culture that they've replaced many of our own memories. And if you ask people what their life resembles, more people will say a movie than anything else. Without any sort of prompting that this has to be a kind of art or anything, they'll say my life is a movie. And the fact that we live that way struck me thematically as the kind of thing that I should be writing about. But I don't, some people will say to me, boy, the producer in here is so sleazy. And I think, in a way, he's a bit of a hopeful character. And I don't blame Hollywood in some way. I feel like Hollywood reflects us back to ourselves. I feel
he's hilariously funny.
I think he's greatly funny. Yeah. He has had so much plastic surgery. And I think he's strangely a kind of heroic figure by the end. He is the person who's going to hopefully bring Pasquale and Dee back together after 50 years.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read that great sentence description of him and his treatments.
Sure. It may be impossible to trace the sequence of facials, spa treatments, mud baths, cosmetic procedures, lifts and staples, collagen implants, outpatient touch-ups, tannings, Botox injections, cyst and growth removals, and stem cell injections that have caused a 72-year-old man to have the face of a 9-year-old Filipino girl.
Now, this book is starting to appear on the bestseller list.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, because obviously you've stuck to it, and, you know, at what point does it become safe to give up a dream? You know, Los Angeles, Hollywood is a place that's full of people who don't stop being dreamers.
Right.
Is it ever relinquishable?
I think the dream itself is what's important. I mean, I set out to be a fiction writer 25 years ago, sending out short stories that I used to call Manila boomerangs, because I would mail them out and they would come back to me 6 weeks later. And I during that time, I told myself that the thing I wrote would be what I would measure myself by. And I'm constantly having to check my motivation for those reasons, because I don't write to be on the bestseller list. It's a wonderful, incredible surprise. I don't write to win awards or even reviews, which I take great pride in, but I write for the page. I write for the thing itself. And that dream seems wholly healthy and rewarding. When I have a good writing day, I've never encountered a feeling like that. It's just the best feeling I know. And so if I stay true to that dream, and so many of the characters in the book, the book is really in a way about the process of writing itself. There's a character named Alvis Bender in it who can't get past the first chapter of his book, much as I couldn't get past the first chapter of this book for several years. There are other characters who are, almost every character except Pasquale is an artist of some kind trying to create something.
But he's an artist who wants to imagine a fabulous resort, cliffside, in a place that doesn't have a beach, has no room for tennis courts, but he's willing to level a clifftop, a mountaintop.
His idea of cantilevering a tennis court out over the boulders is I think, I would agree that his life ends up becoming his art, you know, the way he describes it. So everyone, the other side of that striving for a dream or for some other vision of your life than the one you're living, I think is this remarkable thing. And even the Hollywood characters are, they want to make something great. I've worked in Hollywood a little bit, and I've never met someone who didn't get in it to make something great. Do they get derailed? Does money become the thing that they end up seeking? Sure, as for all of us, you know. But the motivation to create is something I think is one of the things I love about the characters in this book and the kinds of people I'm drawn to in life.
So I want to say that Beautiful Ruins is the example of a pleasurable book that also is meaningful and that doesn't push its meaning in anyone's face. But I would say that whereas some books leave you sadder but wiser, this book leaves you happier but wiser, and it's really a pleasure to have a book like that.
Yeah. I'm not sure, you know, where that comes from, but a lot of readers are telling me that, and I think it's, you know, again, I look at the things the characters go through, and it doesn't feel as if they've had an easy go of it. I think it's the place they cross over to. I think of Wallace Stegner's phrase, crossing to safety, you know, and I think to meet characters who've crossed to some point in their lives when they can look back and reflect on it is something that we can only do in a novel. You know, a film has trouble capturing that.
Well, I think this is the alternative to a Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
That nothing is unearned, and yet it does not deflate the excited desire that leads a reader through a book.
You don't
come to an ending that devastates you. It stays aloft. It's buoyant.
Oh, thank you.
I've been talking with Jess Walter, author most recently of Beautiful Ruins, published by Harper. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Connie Alvarez is my co-producer. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craigor Thine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. I am a book.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.